Российская колонна с гуманитарной помощью...
Так, заявил, что колонну не пропустят через Харьковскую область.
Российская гуманитарная колонна, движущаяся граница с Украиной...
На юго-востоке Украины остается напряженная, можно начать...
В окрестностях Донецка при ночных обстрелах погиб один человек.
Ялтинская речь российского президента Владимира Путина, которую он произнесет сегодня...
уникальную объединяющую роль для России, заявил сегодня Владимир Путин.
Вот это цитата.
A Russian convoy lingers in the Ukrainian border amid suspicions that it contains more than just humanitarian aid. Ukrainian forces continue to make gains on pro-Moscow separatists in the country's east, shelling the center of the rebel-held city of Donetsk for the first time as top rebel leaders resign and flee. And Vladimir Putin is strangely invisible, despite giving what the Kremlin had billed as a major speech in Crimea. After months of fierce fighting, frantic diplomacy, and bitter acrimony, the Ukraine crisis appears to be careening towards endgame, and Vladimir Putin appears to be losing the initiative and running out of options. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Kyiv is Andreas Umland, a longtime Kremlin watcher, an expert on Russian nationalism, and a professor at Kyiv Mohyla Academy. Welcome, Andreas.
Hello.
And also joining us via Skype from London is Peter Pomerantsev, author of the forthcoming book, Nothing is True and Everything is Possible, The Surreal Heart of the New Russia. Thanks for joining us, Peter. And I must say, I absolutely love that title and am looking forward to the publication of your book come November.
Oh, thank you very much. It's a short, snappy title.
It's a great title. Now, looking back at the past week, when the Kremlin hypes a spectacle, you expect it to be spectacular. And for weeks, they had been building anticipation for Putin's August 14th speech in Yalta. The anticipation only increased as Russia massed troops in the Ukrainian border, an aid convoy lumbered toward that same border, and fears of a Russian invasion reached fever pitch. And then nothing. Well, almost nothing. I mean, the Kremlin hit the mute button on the speech a half hour before. There was no live broadcast. It was nothing special. The speech itself was a common mix of confrontational and conciliatory rhetoric. Obsessive Russia watchers like us had to content ourselves with bits and pieces that were released in print. For a Kremlin that is obsessed with optics, it was, to say the least, very odd. My initial take is that Putin appears boxed into a corner right now. He faces two very unpalatable options in eastern Ukraine: accept defeat or invade. And he really doesn't know what to do. Now, going back to the speech, Peter, you pay a lot of attention to this regime's use of spectacle and optics. You're one of the more astute observers of this aspect of Kremlin policy. What did you make of this, hitting the mute button on this speech 30 minutes before it was scheduled to start, after billing it and hyping it for so long?
Well, listen, I mean, I always my background is in television, and I worked inside Russian television for a while. And so I always try to look at it from the point of view of a television producer or director. And, you know, the Kremlin is all about sort of creating movies. I mean, they talk about this quite openly. Politics is a sort of a ratings show. I think it's, as a director, I think it's quite a good move. You hype you hype one storyline, then pull that down and completely switch it by pushing a bunch of sort of military vehicles into Donetsk. And having this bizarre spectacle of all these sort of humanitarian trucks circling around the border. So if you look at the Putin speech as the only movie, then it's bizarre. If you take all the factors they've been playing with over the last 3 days, which is the humanitarian convoy, the actual military stuff going over the border, Putin and Crimea, Putin was almost the decoy. The whole Putin story was the decoy story. The real story was the pushing the trucks over the border. And now the bizarre decoy story is going to be this humanitarian shindig. So I'm not, you know, I you could say he's running out of options. You could say very cunning use of narratives. We're all confused. That's the point. We're all spun.
So it worked. This is still something from the classic Kremlin playbook. It wasn't a departure from that playbook, I don't think.
Yeah, I mean, playbook. Yeah, look, there's two ways to look at the Kremlin. You know, they're a complete disaster, or they're actually quite cunning. And obviously, you know, both factors are often true. But I don't think the fact that they muted the speech after bumping it up for so long is necessarily a sign that they're losing the plot. That could well have been the kind of, you know, the kind of little game that they played with us. They do that all the time.
Andreas, would you agree? What do you think?
Well, it's very difficult to interpret because it might be an expression of different things, because it could be just a change of tactic. It could be a sign of confusion. It might be all a scenario played out that was sort of put there in before. We will see what the policies actually will be. But it is indeed a bit strange that first the live presentation of the speech is announced and then it's not done, actually.
There's been several things written in the media in the last week or so about how Putin's kind of running out of options. There was a nice piece Owen Matthews penned in Newsweek about this. Ben Judah had a piece in Politico about how basically Putin's options are running out if you look at the situation on the ground, because the Ukrainian forces are closing in on the rebels. The Kremlin right now, it's hard for them to continue this kind of nonlinear war policy. Right now, it's the rebels are on the verge of defeat. Strelkov resigned yesterday, for God's sakes, after reports that he'd been injured the day before severely. The choice seems to be now accept defeat or invade, no?
Yes, that could be true. I mean, it depends, of course, on what the perception of the Kremlin is. If they really have the view that this is really putting pressure on them, or if they are just undecided because they think they still have many options, but they cannot decide which one to take. But indeed, I mean, since the downing of the Malaysian airliner, the international community has sort of come together, and there is a more consolidated position now, and that is making things more difficult for Putin. It could be also that there is actually a fight of factions going on in the Kremlin, and maybe this sort of wavering that we've seen in the last days is an expression of this, that different the doves and the more radical people are in a fight in the Kremlin. Unfortunately, we don't know much about this.
Yeah, no, and another thing that's kind of caught my attention is that, and Peter, this is up your alley, the Kremlin's mastery of virtual reality up until now. They've been able to create these scenarios, play with dramaturgia, play with optics. And your initial comments seem to indicate to me you may not agree with this, but they seem to be losing control of that because people aren't buying it as much anymore outside of Russia. Would you agree? Is this game finally catching up with them?
In terms of trying to play the West and sort of like
situation.
It seems to be. I mean, there's definitely, as Andreas says, a hardening of the rhetoric, and there seems to be. I mean, when did maybe Andreas can give us more information about this? What are the exact criteria for Tier 3 sanctions kicking in? I mean, because the next round of sanctions is meant to be particularly tough. I mean, what is the exact red line that the Kremlin can dance along? So I suppose that's really the thing to think about when we talk about the West. I mean, perception is fine, but what really matters is action. As for inside the country, well, listen, I think we've seen for the last couple of weeks, Putin is trying to reset the narrative. So he's already started to put out sort of Kudrin and Kolesnikov, who are sort of obviously the more liberal part of the establishment, sort of trying to spin a more liberal line. The hardliners are being more hardline than ever. So he's trying to reposition himself in a new middle, which is obviously the place where he's always felt comfortable. So I think that those are the things going on.
One has to wonder, and you look at Kremlin information policy pretty closely. I mean, if I was thinking this through yesterday, the two options, right? Invade, that has potentially catastrophic consequences for Russia. It really does. Back off. Now, people have been saying if he backs off, he's going to face a nationalist backlash at home. His popularity is going to go down. But do you think he could spin backing down?
This is the big question. And I've been to Russia several times since this crisis started to crest. You know, the system is not geared towards 80% support of Putin. The system is geared towards a slight kind of passive acceptance. 60% was perfect. 80% is like too hot for the system. So there is this kind of idea that, oh, my God, we've unleashed these passions. However, when I sort of travel across Russia and talk to people, it's mainly the usual kind of passive-aggressive drip-drip. Mm. I wonder how nervous the Kremlin really is about kind of like a backlash inside the country. I think maybe that's what they're trying to calculate. They're more interested in trying to get a sense of their own people rather than, what the West will do.
Right, because we've talked in this podcast in the past about most of Putin's third term, there's been this kind of permanent mobilization, right? And it's hard to keep that intensity for too long. And you're saying, I mean, why is 80% too hot? What is too hot about that?
Well, because at the end of the day, it's a system based on kind of a loose cynicism most of the time. I steal, you steal, we all steal together. It's not really built on sort of like, you know, passionate belief and fervor. And it's kind of, it's not in that sense a totalitarian system. It's very much an authoritarian system. It's built on people being involved in politics rather than people getting really involved. I mean, that's why they had to cut off Dugin at one point. And whenever a passionate kind of movement arises, they cut it off very quickly because the system is just not geared towards ideological commitment. Mm-hmm. Passionate commitment. It can use ideology when it needs it. So it's always building one clan up, cutting it down, building another clan up, cutting it down. That's the logic of the system. That's not a system that has a kind of ideological fervor built into it. So there's a caution about, you know, people getting too patriotic. They want them kind of to be patriotic and yet passive at the same time. Mm. That's probably what they're mainly interested in.
So you think they can spin their way out of a climb down on this?
I think that's what they're going to try to do. I mean, now it's Putin the humanitarian. You know, they're moving away from saving all, you know, the Russian stuff to Putin the humanitarian. There's been a campaign inside of Russia of adverts saying the people encouraging us to go to war are CIA spies because they want to push us into a war that we don't need. So there's quite a lot of PR they're doing inside of the country to kind of change the debate from let's invade to no, we should save, you know, we should do a humanitarian mission and the people trying to provoke war are, of course, the Americans who want the Third World War. We're the peacekeepers.
That's an interesting point you raise. And Andreas, now you follow Russian nationalism close. We spoke in this podcast several weeks back about the role of nationalists. Now, if what Peter is saying is true, what's your take on that? Do you think they could spin this down? Can they tame this monster that they've cranked up over the past several months?
Yeah, well, my reading is that they are trying to find a new way to sort of keep Ukraine destabilized, but not any longer with these terrorists. I think this there might be now, or I'm speculating, that there might be now a disillusionment about this whole uprising in the Donbas and that it might be too costly and too risky for them. And now they're trying to maybe find a new tactic to keep Ukraine in this sort of tense situation, keep the investment climate, the business climate down in Ukraine, but through other means than this terrorist uprising in the east. I think the invasion is probably something which is on the table, but if you look on the last Levada poll, there is a lot of anti-Americanism and a lot of conspirology now widespread in the Russian population, which thinks that all these things have to do basically with the U.S., but on the other hand, you also see that a tendency of the voters, of the people who were asked, the respondents, for Russia not to get too much involved in Ukraine. And so the invasion is I think, a risky path to go, not just in terms of further sanctions from the West, but also because the assessment of the Russian public of such an official involvement of the Russian army in Ukraine would be difficult to predict, and maybe they are now looking for new ways to either continue the uprising in eastern Ukraine in a new format or find entirely new ways to destabilize the situation.
Yeah, no, that Levada poll was striking because support for an invasion has dropped into the 40s, if I'm not mistaken, and it's been dropping steadily for several polls. Support for humanitarian assistance remains very high, of course. But in that, as you pointed out, amid this widespread belief that Russia's really done nothing wrong here, I think the specter of Russians fighting Ukrainians and Russians coming home in body bags is something that's giving the public pause. But as far as this nationalist monster, Andreas, do you think this can be tamed? I mean, Peter seems to think so. They can kind of tamp this down. Do you think that's possible, or is it possible that Putin's going to face a fierce backlash from these people?
Well, I think it has now become a factor in Russian domestic politics, and these people like Kurginyan, Dugin, Parkhanov, they have now become very prominent, and their positions are now well accepted. 15 years ago, they were still marginals and seen as rather bizarre personalities, but now they are in the almost in the mainstream. But they're certainly parts of the political establishment. So they have to consider this factor now, and it depends on how strong this camp really is, how much influence it has on public opinion, and also how weighty it is perceived in the Kremlin. Maybe they see it still as something that can be manipulated back and forth, and that can be brought down and brought up again. I also tend to think that the Kremlin probably can still sort of regulate that, but probably it's now not as easily done as maybe 10 years ago when these conspirologists and basically fascists, or partly at least fascists, were still more marginal than they are today. So it's difficult to say how the Kremlin perceives the threat of nationalism and how real it really is. But it has become a more important factor than 10 or 20 years ago.
Mm. Peter, would you agree? Because the way you painted the situation very succinctly is that they need to ramp this down and basically rely on this kind of tacit acceptance and cynicism. But at the same time, for the past half year, they've kind of cranked up this monster. And can they put this monster back in the box?
No, it hasn't been the last half year. This is the thing that started in 2011. It was their way to spin their way out of the protest, was to change the story from one about sort of bad governance into a story about, you know, holy Russia versus...
Right. They've cranked it up to 11 the past few months, I guess.
Yeah. But Ukraine kind of like super, that was like series two. It was just like so much better. But listen, they want both. They're trying to do both. They want to have this kind of bubbling sort of passive-aggressive patriotism, which is both paranoid and passive. So they're doing the whole paranoia thing, they're doing the whole conspirology. But one also has to look at the method of control in Russia. And the method of control is always, and it has been like this for decades, if not centuries, is to build up one clan, take him down, build up another clan, take him down. This is the way Putin operates. If your method of control is that, you can never build up a sort of a big sort of fascist ideological movement, because that requires sort of one team that pushes forward. If you're constantly undercutting people, you're always going to keep society sort of jumping from foot to foot. Andreas, you mentioned the Levada poll that people aren't for the invasion. But the Kremlin himself has created the stories and the PR and the fake news to put people off the idea of an invasion. So they've regulated this already. They could have ramped it up. We've got to save everybody in Donetsk. This is the Kremlin controlling people's opinions. It's not it reacting to people. It creates the story, then the polls show. They go, oh, look, the polls are showing. So one has to be careful there. So I don't think they've lost complete control. They're still doing what they do. Are we sure that the nationalists are the big risk? Isn't the silent bourgeois majority in Moscow more of a risk? Because they're getting really fed up now. As the nationalists are completely infiltrated, completely under control, they don't have any money, and, you know, they can basically be locked up overnight. Isn't the Navalny vote, who went kind of Krimnash for a while, but are now really irritated by all this bullshit about not being able to cross borders, much more of a problem for them?
Well, the Navalny vote is a complicated vote. The Navalny vote brought in a lot of these nationalists as well. And it kind of was a marriage of this liberal bourgeois, urban professional class and nationalists. And now what maybe the risk is that if Putin does back down, he's going to alienate both of these camps again.
Yes, yes. I mean, I'm not sure, like, were there any good statistics about what percentage were nationalists in the end and which were liberals? Because I think mainly, actually, it was actually the liberals in the end who voted for him. And he had to kind of, and we saw him change his narrative a little bit as he realized who his core vote were. I don't know. I mean, every time I've looked at nationalist movements in Russia, that's you know, it always reminds me of sort of like, sort of various kind of like movements in 19th century Dostoevsky novels, sort of anarchists and stuff. They seem completely infiltrated. Are they really such a serious hydra that's out there?
Yeah, no, that's a good point. The leadership certainly is, but basically political science teaches us that when there's a threat of revolution, it's when you have diminished expectations, when you have heightened expectations and then they're disappointed. We saw this at the end of 2011. You had the urban bourgeois class basically disappointed by Putin's return because they had hoped for a new thaw under a second Medvedev term. They didn't get that. They were disappointed. They took to the streets. Now that was brought under control. But then you had the nationalist hopes built up. With this whole Ukraine campaign, now that's being disappointed, right? Isn't that risky, Andreas? What do you think?
Well, I think there are two kinds of nationalism, and which are partly in contradiction to each other. So Putin is playing the imperial nationalism card, and it's more about anti-Americanism, about recollecting the lost lands, the resurrection of the Russian Empire. But the support for Navalny is
a good
isolationist,
point.
Maybe also a more racist.
It's an ethnic nationalism,
nationalism, and these nationalists that are closer to the opposition, they are actually. I want to see the polls or some research on that. But I would suspect that they are more sympathetic towards Ukraine. They may even support Ukrainian nationalism. They may even see Ukrainian nationalism as something equivalent to their own nationalism, and they wouldn't be so keen on getting additional territories. Some of them are actually in favor of getting rid of the Northern Caucasus because it sort of disturbs the Russian nation building and so on. So there is this other kind of nationalism emerging, which is also unpleasant, which is racist and very Russocentric, but which is less imperialist and which is also less obsessed with America and imperial expansion. And so I think there is also a conflict in the nationalist movement about what actually is good for the Russian nation. Although Ukraine, of course, and Belarus, of course, are very touchy issues, maybe even northern Kazakhstan, because these are seen as territories or as parts of the former Soviet empire that, of course, also fit into this ethnic nationalism paradigm, in that either all of the Ukrainians and Belarusians, or at least parts of them, the ethnic Russian citizens of Belarus and Ukraine, could be seen as being part of the ethnic Russian nation that needs protection from the Russian state. So it's a rather complicated picture, but it doesn't necessarily play into Putin's hands. If he's sort of if he's going for this confrontation with Ukraine and the West, because there might be nationalists who actually think that this is bad for the Russian nation.
No, that's the point you raise, and also it's notable to point out that Navalny himself was vocally and persistently a supporter of the Euromaidan, and vocally and persistently an opponent of the annexation of Crimea and the actions in eastern Ukraine. So now I don't know if that extends to his supporters. I'd like to see data on that. But we there is plenty of data on Navalny. Just look at his Twitter feed. And he's been a consistent supporter, who in Navalny, incidentally, is partially of Ukrainian descent. Before we move on to the last section, Andreas, I wanted to touch on something with you as an observer of both Russia and Ukraine. If Putin does back down here, my take is that Russia's basically lost Ukraine forever as a client state. Now, my first question to you would be, do you think that's true? And my second question would be, how psychologically devastating would that be for Russia, given the importance Ukraine plays in Russian mythology?
Well, I think what you just said has actually already happened. And basically every day this war continues in eastern Ukraine. It's the Ukrainian population as a whole is getting more and more disillusioned with
including Russian speakers.
Yes, I think there is also a growing tendency here among Russian speakers, even ethnic Russians, of taking sides actually with Ukraine, because they are in different information sphere here, and they see, of course, the Russian propaganda, but they also see the Ukrainian position, I think many of them actually end up then on the Ukrainian side, and they make then a distinction between Putin and Russia, and so on. I think it's as you mentioned at the beginning, much of what is happening in Ukraine, it's about spinning and about dramaturgia and about the scenario that Putin can present to Russia. So I think what they are fishing for is here a story of chaos and anarchy in Ukraine that could then be presented as an example of what happens to a large Eastern Slavic country, Orthodox country, when it gets involved with the West, when it signs an association agreement with the EU, when it goes for an alliance with the US. So I think that's actually now their main focus, and as long as they can hold up this this sort of pseudo-threat that apparently or seemingly Ukraine exemplifies, that is going to be good for the regime, and that's going to be enough for them. And then, well, then Ukraine is lost, but it's lost because basically the West has taken it, and because the Ukrainians have lost their Slavic Orthodox soul and sold it to the West, to the U.S. As long as they can spin this story, I think it's fine for the regime. Of course, in the long term, this will be a big problem then for Russian nationalism, Russian national identity, and intellectual discourse. But I don't think the regime is very much interested in that. These people in the Kremlin are not very ideological. They want to keep power, and they're going to spin whatever story is good for that.
Well, what I keep coming back to, though, is any Russian imperial project cannot get off the ground, doesn't have any oxygen, so to speak, without Ukraine, right? And if Russia's lost Ukraine, does that spell the beginning of the end of the Russian imperial idea?
Yes, but it depends on how you spin it. I mean, if the loss is then presented as something that is bringing chaos and division and anarchy to Ukraine, that could be also, I mean, for the regime, that could be something good. I don't think the regime is as such imperial. I mean, the imperialism is just one of the instruments.
Right, one of the tools in the toolbox.
I don't think they really care about Ukraine. I don't think they even really care about Donbas or Crimea and so on. It's useful for them as long as they can sort of play with Russian public opinion using these themes. And they may be able to continue playing with that if they can basically keep Ukraine in this sort of economically depressed, socially depressed stage. And that's, I think, where the West has to come in.
Right, the West, and a lot's going to be
support.
Right, and a lot's going to depend on the Ukrainians themselves. Well, in a few moments, we will continue our discussion of the apparent endgame of the Ukraine crisis and of Putin's dwindling options. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from Kyiv is Andreas Umland, a longtime Kremlin watcher, an expert on Russian nationalism, and a professor at Kyiv Mohyla Academy. And also joining us via Skype from London is Peter Pomerantsev, author of the forthcoming book, Nothing is True and Everything is Possible, The Surreal Heart of the New Russia. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
В соответствии с Конституцией, уходя в отставку, я подписал указ о возложении обязанностей президента России на председателя правительства Владимира Владимировича Путина.
Было бы совершенно нелепо ответить, что не готов, если президент так сказал.
Well, there's a blast from the past. I remember watching all that live. That was Yeltsin's resignation on New Year's Eve, 1999-2000. Vladimir Putin passed a milestone this past week. On August 9th, 1999, 15 years ago, Boris Yeltsin plucked Putin out of obscurity to name him as prime minister and as his designated successor. I'm going to read for you a pretty representative example of how the media covered the development. Quote, analysts say that Putin, an uninspiring speaker who rarely makes public statements, would be a tough sell in Russia's presidential elections. That was written by none other than me. Well, I was wrong. And Putin's been defying his detractors ever since. He seems to have an almost supernatural ability to come out on top. Peter, do you think Putin's luck is finally running out, or can he continue pulling rabbits out of the hat? Or is this Ukraine crisis a bridge too far for him?
You see, I mean, I think I differ from most analysts of Russia in the sense that I'm suspicious, epistemologically suspicious, about reading the Putin era as an extension of Putin's brilliance and personality. I do, probably because of the angle I come through it at, I really do see him as almost like a Pelevin-like hallucination, a creation. And there was, at the same time, Surkov, who was the sort of, the great illusionist of Russian politics for a while, gave this famous toast around 2000, to the sanctification of power. And so the whole Putin project has been about creating this sense of an almost sort of like, blessed, preternaturally lucky ruler. So the question, I'm sure he makes as many mistakes as the rest of us, but it's been all about creating this sense around him that he's got it. Whatever he is, he's got it. It's like in a Nike ad. And it's really a question about whether that media... that media trick starts to collapse, not whether Putin's luck. It's all a game of illusions. And at the moment, what we're seeing is the kind of the illusory world reach this kind of bizarre point where nobody can tell real from unreal anymore in Russian media. And we've entered this slightly sort of schizophrenic world where you're never quite sure whether people are sort of playing at a game or whether they believe in it. That's very worrying because there's a, I think for a lot of observers of Russia, we're not really sure whether they're making rational decisions or whether they've, as Kerry said, begun to believe their own propaganda. So it's really whether that system collapses in on itself rather than Putin's luck. Putin's luck is a story that's sold. I mean, that's my sense anyway.
But there's objective reality, too. And Putin's also been very lucky. High oil prices. Without the high oil prices, I don't think he would have been able to pull off this illusion. And sooner or later, this is going to bump into the reality of the economy. This week, Igor Sechin requested 15 trillion rubles for Rosneft, saying if Rosneft doesn't get this money, it's going to have to default. The sanctions are beginning to bite. And even without the sanctions, Russia has objective economic problems. Can't this illusion bump into reality at some point?
Yes, you're right. There's always, we saw that with the plane. Putin doesn't really want a war in the Donbass. He wanted a movie about a war, and then they go and shoot out a bloody plane. And the illusion becomes real. It was an absolute disaster. Listen, this Maidan thing. One thing that I keep on returning to, why did the Kremlin do this? Even before Maidan, listen, they had Ukraine locked down. They had the most Russia-friendly president who was completely corrupt. They completely infiltrated Ukraine economically, security-wise. Why did they start this ridiculous fight over the association agreement? When the association agreement was nothing, it was like something you sign and then 350 laws you have to pass over 10 years. It's a joke. I mean, nobody in the Kremlin thinks in terms of 10 years. Why did they start this bloody fight over the association agreement? And the only rational explanation that I've been offered was that they were trying to do a financial trick. So basically, they had the deal with Yanukovych. Ages ago, they'd given 15 billion. Most of it would return as Zatkat. So it was a bit of corruption, big level corruption that went horribly wrong. And that's where they trip up. They trip up when, their own greed gets involved. So, there's an old Russian saying, Жадность фрая разгубила. So maybe Putin's tragic fault is greed and corruption. And that, I think, will bring him down. And I suspect that's what is at the root of this whole Ukrainian story. But I can't prove it.
Andreas, your thoughts.
Yes, I agree with Peter, but I would still think that the association agreement has a somewhat higher meaning and had a somewhat higher meaning during the Yanukovych presidency, because it would have symbolized, had Yanukovych signed it in November 2013, it would have symbolized at least a sort of move of Ukraine towards Europe, and that was something in a way unacceptable for Putin, and that's why they choose this fight, and they miscalculated simply, I think, because they saw that Yanukovych's regime is more stable than it eventually then was. So I think that actually this whole question of whether Ukraine is a part of Europe or not is actually a core question, and it's not only about the corruption. And although I agree with Peter that this is also a large part of it, but what they basically needed from Yanukovych is the sort of illusion for the Russian public that Ukraine is still ours. And then when this all didn't work out and Yanukovych was overthrown, then they came with plan B, with Crimea, with eastern Ukraine, and then basically now the strategy is, if we cannot get the whole of Ukraine, we can get at least pieces mm-hmm. out of it, and that will then make the Russian public happy too.
No, I think Peter raises a good point here, because if you look back at the association agreement, it would have been a minor nuisance, right?
Yeah, it made it into a story. It wasn't a story.
Yeah, it was. I mean, suddenly this obscure thing looks like a major story. I mean, Russia's encouraging Serbia to join the EU because they want a Trojan horse in there. But yet they didn't even want Ukraine to sign. So that was the Euromaidan. Now that I saw as an existential threat. Sure. And it makes sense why they dialed it up to 11 after that, because a truly democratic revolution in a culturally similar Slavic Orthodox country next door is deadly for these people. And it was beginning to inspire the Russian opposition, by the way. If you think back, if you remember back to early this year, they were very inspired. So that I see. But I agree that I'm a little bit puzzled of them picking such a fight over the association agreement.
They thought they'd win it. I can see. I mean, again, this is me trying to get into their heads. But like, I can see them sitting around going, you know, should we do, look, they had, Ukraine wasn't leaving Russia's orbit. You know, they could have actually made a joke out of the association agreement. Ha, 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 look how corrupt the EU is. Yanukovych, and they could have spun this in any way they wanted to. They could have just not talked about it in Russia if they cared about their inner narrative. Ukraine wasn't going anywhere. You could just see them sitting out and going, hold on, we can make a hell of a lot of money. We have this fake battle with Yanukovych, even though we know we're going to win it, because we know that at the end of it, we give him 15 billion. He doesn't sign. We get 10 billion back, la, la, la. You can just see them planning it all. And then, you know, of course, they don't counter in reality, which is Maidan or the plane, or whatever's going to happen next. So, of course, you're right. Of course, these illusory games hit reality. The problem is, I mean, how big is the shot going to be in Russia?
Yeah, no, and this is the big question going forward. And this is going back to the original question I posed at this. Has Putin's luck finally run out? Is the illusory game bumping into reality? I guess we'll see in the coming weeks, months, and years. Either of you have any last thoughts before we wrap it up for this week?
I thought Andreas said the key thing, which is the Kremlin is looking for new ways to invade. So non-linear hybrid war seems to be coming to an end simply because they're losing. Even though they just sent a bunch of, you know, military stuff over the border. When I was in Moscow, everyone was like, we've got to keep the non-linear war. People around the Duma that I talked to all said, we've got to keep the non-linear war bubbling until 2018. They obviously can't do that now. I think the plan at the moment is to keep this going until winter and then gasify.
Right.
Yeah, start using that. Isn't? What do you think, Andreas?
Yeah, last thoughts, Andreas, before we wrap it up.
Yeah, I think Putin is now entering a new reality. And I think the key point, Brian, you talked already about that the oil prices are going down and that the economy is not doing as well as it used to do. But I wouldn't underestimate him. He is a... he's a KGB agent. He sort of he knows how to to do things, and maybe he will find a new way to legitimize his regime, not on economic performance, but with some sort of new international mission and new propaganda strategies. So he might be still there for a few years, but I think the challenges will now be much higher than they used to be, and the West can actually make it even more challenging for Putin if it keeps on pressuring.
All right, well, on that note, we'll wrap it up. That's all we have time for today. I would like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Kyiv has been Andreas Umland, a longtime Kremlin watcher, an expert on Russian nationalism, and a professor at Kyiv Mohyla Academy. Also joining us via Skype from London has been Peter Pomerantsev, author of the forthcoming book, Nothing is True and Everything is Possible, The Surreal Heart of the New Russia. Pick up your copy in November. Thank you, gentlemen, for an enlightening discussion.
Good night.
And I'd also like to thank our patient, brilliant, and overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally awesome Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week, and now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.